Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
President Donald Trump weighed in on the race for New York's 21st congressional district this week, endorsing Amsterdam businessman Anthony Constantino on Tuesday. Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine has more about how Trump's backing could shake up the Republican primary.
On his social media platform Truth Social Tuesday, President Trump called Sticker Mule founder Anthony Constantino a great guy who will never let you down, writing that Constantino has his complete and total endorsement. In backing Constantino in the Republican primary against New York State Assemblyman Robert Smullen, Trump is supporting a candidate who has effusively praised and flattered him. Constantino hung a controversial sign atop his business's Amsterdam factory in support of Trump during the 2024 campaign. He gifted the president a 7-foot bronze sculpture of himself last year, and he also released a music album called Thank You, President Trump. Meanwhile, Smullen has called himself the only Trump-appointed candidate in the race, referencing his 2018 appointment to the President's Commission on White House Fellows. Smullen spoke with reporters following the endorsement.
We are winning because we have earned the support of voters across New York 21 who want a proven conservative fighter. We are endorsed by law enforcement, by labor, local Republican committees, every Republican committee of the New York, every Republican member of the New York Assembly, as well as the New York State Republican and conservative parties. That does not change. Nothing about our campaign will change. Anthony Constantino is not the candidate voters in New York 21 support. He has proven he is mentally unfit to serve in Congress.
Smullen has been endorsed by 12 of the 15 Republican county committees in the 21st district. In a statement, New York State GOP committee chair Ed Cox said, quote, "We endorsed and will continue to work with Robert Smullen as the best candidate to represent the people of New York 21 and the candidate most viable in the general election," end quote. In a statement, Constantino said he looks, quote, "forward to winning the general election and making everyone who supported me very proud," end quote. Skidmore political science professor Bob Turner says Trump's endorsement changes the dynamics of June's GOP primary.
It started as a establishment versus outsider candidate where the party chairs were endorsing Smullen and Constantino had the more money and the sort of maybe greater name recognition as this outsider. With the endorsement of Donald Trump, I think it becomes very likely for Constantino to win. 91% of the Republican challengers that Trump has endorsed have won their primary races.
Turner adds that it's difficult enough for candidates to simply get the attention of voters during a primary race.
Primary voters are different than general election voters. They tend to be more ideological. They tend to be more partisan. And on the Republican side, they're going to tend to be, you know, far more loyal supporters of Donald Trump. And so if they have this one piece of information that Donald Trump feels that Constantino is his guy, well, for many of them, that's all they need. They don't need any more information.
Republican Elise Stefanik has been the North Country's congressional representative for more than a decade. She is not seeking re-election after she also ended a New York gubernatorial bid late last year. On the Democratic side, Blake Gendebien, a Lisbon dairy farmer, and Stuart Amriel, a Lake Placid restaurant owner, are facing off in June. Gendebien received the state Democratic endorsement last year when it appeared a special election would take place after Stefanik was tapped to serve in the United Nations, a nomination that Trump ultimately withdrew. Turner says November's election will be interesting regardless of what happens in the primary.
You know, on the Democratic side, it looks a lot to me more like 2006, where the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee would try to choose candidates that fit the district really well. So to try and choose a moderate, longtime dairy farmer who's not a Washington insider, right? That's that kind of model, right? And so in some ways it's going to be an interesting referendum, both on the Trump presidency, but also about whether we are going to go to a more district-centered model of congressional elections or continue the sort of nationalization of congressional elections.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello-Levine.
Elise Stefanik has maintained a relatively low profile since announcing the end of her run for governor and her impending exit from Congress. It's a far cry from the national spotlight the Republican received in 2023 when her probing of college presidents about anti-Semitism on campus went viral. Stefanik details that time in her new book, which she recently discussed with the New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind. As you'll hear, they also got into the congressman's future and New York politics.
I always ask this of authors, what emotion or what response did you want a reader to come away from the book with? Because I detected in your reading a lot of anger. You seem very angry that this had happened, but I'm wondering, what do you hope for a reader to read this and come away with?
I think it is important historically to have all of these, they're more than incidences, but have this crisis that these students faced in one volume, because my fear, Jimmy, was that over time, and even now, traditional media would sort of brush this under the rug, saying this was only a few incidences at a few different campuses. The book captures that this was a widespread systemic crisis at a very important moment in time that is the hinge point of having to rebuild higher education. And I also felt that these stories need to be told. I mean, these are horrific stories. Some of this was verbal testimony given in front of Congress, but some of it was, you know, just told to our office as a part of the overall investigation. And those stories need to be heard. They need to be listened to, and they need to be shared broadly to the country as a way, as a wake-up call to put forth solutions. I could have just focused on the bad apples. That's why at the end I focused on the positives of here are models that we could achieve in the long run. But, you know, I would ask readers, how can you as an elected official not be angry when you're hearing these stories? Of course, I am appalled at what these students faced, and the, you know, these students and parents felt there was nowhere to go except for Congress because these institutions were just not listening. Parents would have to hire security for their children going from one class to another. That should not happen at any campus, let alone in the United States. So yes, it was challenging to write because each of these instances, every hearing was very jaw-dropping, but when you put them in one volume, it is an indictment of what was happening on these universities.
Another way to read this was that, you know, obviously you're going to be a person who has a career opening at the end of this year. I read it as like almost an argument or a pitch as Elise Stefanik university leader, college leader, or Elise Stefanik education, you know, regulator of sorts. Is that something that you'd be interested in for your next chapter?
I mean, so it's interesting. When I was first elected as a freshman member, you get to choose you get to prioritize committees you want. I was the only Republican freshman my year who put education in my top two. I put Armed Services and Education Committee. And I think this was a sleeper issue. And I've always cared about education. And I talk about that in this book. And I talk about it in the acknowledgments section where I had amazing teachers. And that changed my life for the better, the quality of education that I had, particularly growing up in K-12. And I want to continue to be in this space, but that's been a through point in my entire time in Congress. And I point that out because now everybody wants to be on the Education Committee, but there was a tremendous amount of policy work done in this space even prior to this hearing that didn't get a lot of attention, but that was important work in terms of building up to this moment in time for higher ed. So I'm excited about the next chapter, and I know that education will likely be a part of it.
Anything more specific locked down that you can share?
No, I'm not. Everybody asked that, Jimmy, and I'll make those announcements when I'm ready to. But I'm focused on, you know, I have this book coming out. I'm in the very beginning of sort of the book tour.
Sure. You have any thoughts on the Smullin-Constantino primaries? Is someone you want to endorse, or any thoughts on how it's playing out?
Nope, not weighing in on that primary. I think the voters are going to decide in the district, and the voters will make their voices heard. One other thing, just going back to, and you in particular, because you're a New York-based reporter, I also think what's happening on our college campuses, you can have a direct line to the politics playing out, not just nationally, but in our state, where you have the same people who, or in some cases, who organized the pro-Hamas encampment at Columbia, like Mahmoud Khalil. You can draw a direct line to the organization and the boots on the ground of Mamdani's campaign for mayor. So what happens at these campuses is a direct line to what's playing out in our politics in New York State and, you know, broadly, I would argue nationally, but that's also the lens, is just as a New Yorker seeing this. And then when I was writing it, this was way before the mayor's race, but that's an interesting reflection I've had.
That's outgoing North Country Congresswoman Elise Stefanik speaking with the New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Michael Mulgrew, president of the United Federation of Teachers New York, to talk about current legislative negotiations over the Tier 6 pension plan.
Well, Tier 6 is by far the nastiest tier that public employees have ever seen in the state of New York. And it was really propelled forward for really bad reasons, and as usual, the workers get stuck holding the bag, and now we're just saying we need to right this wrong. Tier 6, you know, it was done at the end of the famous meltdown of Wall Street and the banks, and when they had to all be bailed out by the government, which means they had to be bailed out by the taxpayers. And there was a fear after the bailout that our economy would not recover for, you know, over a decade. And the fear became that the only way to keep the public pension solvent would be to raise contributions by taxing, specifically taxing the rich. So what did the rich people do? They all got together and said, we're going to run a campaign to create a new tier so we don't have to, so they won't be able to tax us to keep their current pension tier. Well, that was all a fabricated lie, and none of it came true. And now we have seen some really negative effects on Tier 6 now that it's 14 years old, which is local governments are paying now more than they've ever paid for pensions, and workers are paying more out of pocket than ever, you know, triple the amount minimally of workers that came before them. And for no reason, because the pensions were fine then, they continued to be fine throughout the recovery of the recession, and now they're pushing past points of they're going to be overfunded. So we think we need to right this wrong and stop making local governments and workers pay money that's just not necessary.
How do we fix it?
Well, you can't fix it through a traditional method. The traditional method is this group of folks known as actuaries will come together and come up and say, this is what it will cost. But they don't have to look at anything except what would the tier have created in revenue for their pension system. Thing is, the pension systems don't need this much revenue in order to stay solvent and be in good shape. So this is going to require real political will to say, we need to take a look at this. We know that people and local governments are overpaying into the pension system and say, we need to come up with some sort of reset of all the different pensions because there's way too much money going into them now. But it's never been done that way at the state level. And, you know, everyone is petrified because the actuaries are saying, no, our job is to tell you what it would cost for us to get all the money that would have been produced under Tier 6. Thing is, there's way too much money being produced by Tier 6 from local governments and workers. So this is really a conundrum because people are trying to hide behind the way it was always done, but we've never had a pension tier that went overboard and so aggressively against workers and local governments.
So as you sit there right now and the legislature in high negotiations over this, what do you predict if you're looking into your political crystal ball here?
They all know something has to be done. There's no doubt about that. All the leaders have publicly said this can't continue because it is having an absolute negative effect on the ability to staff all of the public sector agencies. They're all having massive staffing problems. So we have that issue. And then we're having things we've never had before, which are retention problems. Usually when people work 5 years, they will stay and continue until they can achieve their pension. Now the pension is so hard to achieve, they're just leaving it. We have a much higher number of people leaving after 5 years. They're just throwing their hands up and saying, no way, I'm not doing this. So there is a recognition that something has to be done. The real question here, the crystal ball is opaque and cloudy on this issue is there a political will to say we're not going to do this the normal way because the normal way that we've done this in the past just doesn't apply here? Because if you're just going to say that we're going to continue to have all of this revenue being produced either by local governments and workers or somebody else when it's not necessary, to me, that's just bad decision making and lacking political will. That's the part that's cloudy right now. Doing something, every one of these has to be done.
That's Michael Mulgrew, president of the United Federation of Teachers in New York. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. From creating documents to going through email, some Hudson Valley counties are integrating artificial intelligence into daily operations. The Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra with more.
Glenn Markey is the chief information officer for the Orange County government. He said all 2,500 county employees are getting trained to use Microsoft Copilot AI.
Most of our employees, this AI is new to them. So the goal there is to get our AI, to get our workforce AI ready. So that's what we're going to do the whole year.
He said AI can help with tasks like dumping a long, complicated chain of emails into that chat and getting an executive summary, saving a worker valuable time. He said AI is also great at writing.
Well, AI writing, that one's probably the most used one now is people are using it to create processes, procedures, policies, and plans. They create like a template, and then they customize it after they get the nuts and bolts presented to them. So it's heavily used. That's one of the most productive ways.
In Dutchess County, Jacob Morrison, Deputy Commissioner for the Office of Central and Information Services, said the county is focused on AI for document review and proofreading to make sure public communications are easy to understand. He said AI policies are important to make sure the county uses the technology appropriately.
Ethics is a big concern when it comes to AI, and we want to make sure that any use of it is being used to benefit the public and not at risk.
In her State of the County address, Dutchess County Executive Sue Serino said AI can be a game changer, but she said the county will create an AI committee to develop a countywide AI policy. She also said during her address that the Department of Community and Family Services in the future will use an AI-powered call system for temporary assistance benefits. Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger expressed skepticism towards AI, saying, quote, AI data centers create few jobs, consume unsustainable amounts of energy, and threaten to drive up electricity costs for everyone, unquote. She urged leaders in Albany to support a bill introduced by Democrats Senator Liz Krueger and Assemblymember Anna Kellis that would pause data center permits until more statewide guardrails are in place to protect from, quote, the harmful impacts of these energy-guzzling facilities, Metzger said. Similarly, a Rockland County spokesperson told WAMC via email that the county is exploring a limited and carefully controlled use of AI. The spokesperson added that as AI develops, quote, "We expect that many departments may eventually use AI to support routine administrative tasks and improve efficiency," end quote. Mark Levine, deputy director at the New York State Association of Counties, said his organization is helping counties to navigate the transition to AI.
Our counties are on a continuum, are at the beginning, generally at the start of looking at artificial intelligence and the ways that AI can support their back office operations and also their interactions with the public.
He said some counties have been using AI for a couple of years already. He explained many New York counties are and should develop their own AI policies to guide their work. But he said he thinks AI is where the internet was 20 years ago, meaning it's not going anywhere. But he suggested using a more human-centered approach.
AI should be used, and we're encouraging AI use to supplement or enhance or support the work of the humans that are doing the work of county governance across New York State. It should not replace the human.
Orange County CIO Markey said he is collaborating with other counties in the Mid-Hudson Valley to share best practices on using AI in government. Markey also compared AI to the internet. Some components pose significant risks, while others are beneficial.
It's not a day I don't use like ChatGPT or Copilot. It's really become a way of life for me. And I would encourage people just to experiment with ChatGPT because it's free and everybody has a cell phone, right? Everybody's got a mobile phone. Sign up for ChatGPT and experiment. And then talk to me later after a couple of weeks and see how you feel about it.
I'm Elias Guerra.
Chimney Bluffs State Park along the southern shore of Lake Ontario is one of New York's most striking natural landscapes, and its iconic formations are always eroding. But it's not clear how much modern forces, like climate change, are accelerating a process that's been going on for thousands of years. As the New York Public News Network's Veronica Volk reports, what's happening there may offer a glimpse of how unstable the Earth can be.
Yeah, that, I don't think that was there last time.
Rachel Glade is a geomorphologist, an assistant professor at the University of Rochester. She's on a field trip with her Earth Surface Processes class at the Chimney Bluffs in Wayne County.
So, yeah, we're here at the base of the cliffs now on the beach. It's good the wind died down.
But the group doesn't get far along the shoreline before they have to stop.
But now there's all of this material that clearly failed since the last time I was here. A chunk of this cliff must have fallen off, and we're going to try to go over it, which I think should be fine.
At the Chimney Bluffs, erosion is expected, but this heap of collapsed cliff raises familiar questions about just how fast things are changing. The class carefully climbs over the debris.
Just watch where you step, obviously. Don't step in any holes.
And on the other side, they stand at the base of the bluffs, looking at steep, narrow ridges that seem to rise straight up from the lake.
So you're saying it's wild. Why is it wild? Sorry.
No, it's okay. Hill slopes just don't usually look like that.
The Chimney Bluffs began forming at the end of the last ice age. A massive glacier expanded and carved long, smooth hills called drumlins. When the ice melted, it formed Lake Ontario. And since then, water from above and below has been steadily reshaping those hills, leaving fragile, fast-changing formations along the shore. For visitors like Liz Thompson, an environmental science student in Glade's class, the landscape is part of the draw.
In the sun, the cliffs kind of almost look pink against like this blue, really blue giant lake that almost looks like an ocean.
But she says the changes are also visible.
Yeah, I mean, you can see along the cliffs, there's a lot of tiny failure points. You can kind of see the grasses hanging over or trees almost at a kind of extreme slant, like they're almost about to fall over the cliff.
Some of that erosion is easy to explain. The lake itself plays a role when levels get high and waves get big.
Massive waves, like, crashing onto the shore. So if that happens, that can erode the base, and then that could destabilize it and cause something like a little landslide.
But heavy rain is also part of it, cutting away at the top of the cliffs little by little by pulling sediment along as it flows towards the lake. and all at once, by completely saturating the soil.
Via something called pore pressure, so it basically like pushes the grains apart, makes them less stable, and there's less friction between the grains, and that can lead to something like a landslide or a debris flow.
Heavy rains in late March and early April might also have played a role in a recent landslide in Irondequoit. There, saturated ground along a gully collapsed and forced at least one family to evacuate after officials determined their house was unsafe. Glade says events like this are part of how landscapes behave naturally.
It's just good for people to be aware that erosion is like a common phenomenon everywhere in the world.
But the frequency and intensity of those events can shift, especially with more intense weather.
And so, particularly with precipitation, you know, we expect a kind of flashier system as the climate warms. So there might be longer spells of droughts. And then when it rains, it's more intense because the atmosphere can actually hold more water.
For students here, the changing landscape is also a reminder of why they study it. Julia Duby is another environmental science major in Glade's class.
I think that it's important to study and get a better understanding of how exactly it's going to affect our climate and our landscapes and all the processes that go into shaping the world into what it looks like. And then understanding the human impacts of that as well is something that I find very important.
In Rochester, I'm Veronica Volk for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2617. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.